My pleasure at this time to introduce Professor Bill Malone, who is a professor emeritus from the Department of History at Tulane University. The title of his lecture is A Gift to the World in Black and White, The Music of the South. Professor Malone, prior to his tenure at Tulane, taught at Wisconsin State University, Murray State University, and Southwest Texas State University. In addition to editing the music volume of the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture, he is the author of Music from the True Vine, Mike Seeger's Life and Musical Journey, Working Girl Blues, The Life and Music of Hazel Dickens, and numerous other encyclopedia entries, articles, and books, including Country Music USA, which was published in 1968, has been in print ever since, and was described by one writer as the first definitive academic history of country music. So please join me in welcoming Bill Malone.
Several years ago, I forget the exact date, I think maybe about 1997, I wrote a book called Southern Music, American Music. And I was pretty sure of my thesis at the time. I argued that not only did the Southern styles of music borrow from the American song bag, but that the South, in return, had created most of the genres of music with which we're familiar with in this country. American music was Southern music. Now, I can't say that with all that certitude today because there have been so many demographic and technological changes, but I think that was once true. When you stop to think about it, most every form of music that we've grown up with and know, jazz, blues, gospel, both black and white, ragtime, country, of course, even cowboy, when you consider that those Texas cowboys often tended to be Southerners who had moved to the West and took their culture with them. Even protest. First great body of protest music came out of the Southern labor struggles in places like Harlan County, Kentucky, and Gastonia, North Carolina. The music was distinctive, and it appealed to people for a variety of reasons. Part of it was associated with the romance that shrouded the identity of the region from which it came. The South was an exotic land where time stood still, attractive to Americans who were caught up in the rush of progress, moving on to new ideas and styles. But the South was always a reminder of the older ways, the older forms to which people could retreat. Those romantic ideas are, of course, are the ideas that undergirded the music of Stephen Foster in the 1850s and 60s, the black-faced minstrels who came after him. These musicians began to feed the American public an unending stream of songs about the old folks at home. And about the good old-fashioned ways that people thought still had resonance. In Tin Pan Alley, beginning in the 1890s, fostered a large and continuing body of songwriters like Charles K. Harris and Jack Yellen and Irving Berlin, who wrote song after song about Dixie, a place which in many cases they had never been. The South to them was the land of imagination, but they created songs like Are You From Dixie? Of course, Dixie itself, written by Dan Emmett from Ohio. And that, of course, is a tradition which has continued ever since. The South continues to be the source of musical ideas. Then at the turn of the century, particularly in the years right before World War I, collectors like Cecil Sharp from England discovered the balladry of the Appalachian Mountains and began to emphasize that tradition. So as the decades wore on into the 20th century, when people thought of Southern music, they thought of either the music made by black people, filtered through the minstrels, or those old folk songs and ballads that Appalachian people had preserved, which not realizing that there was a wealth of musical material in every part of the South. But above all, the main argument I'll make today is that Southern music was distinctive because it was shaped by the confluence of two great musical cultures, the African-American and the European-American. And among the Europeans, I suppose that the Scotch-Irish may have had the most influence, along with the Germans who came down through into the Piedmont of the South. But these two great traditions, the African-American and the European, created what you might call a synthesis of styles, what the singer and folklorist Mike Seeger called music from the true vine. He argued that this true vine is what undergirded, what provided the roots for most of American music, as I've said. Before I get into this topic any further, let me first engage in a couple of personal memories. The first time I ever remember hearing any form of black music was in the late 1930s, growing up on a cotton farm in East Texas, about 20 miles west of Tyler, about 80 miles east of Dallas. Every year, down in the pasture, a few miles from where we lived, African-Americans had a revival, and they always sent out the word. They were very happy to have white people attend. This was a little church building, but it was a Church of God in Christ, part of a great holiness revival that swept across both black and white culture at the end of the 19th century. I loved to go as a child because they always had a couple of stands outside where they sold fried catfish and had watermelon and homemade ice cream. But once you got inside, there was a section set aside where white people sat. And we watched the preaching, and at some point during the sermon, the preacher would begin shuffling his feet. That was the sign for the rest of the people who wanted to get up and dance. They did the holy dance all around us out on the main floor of the church. I wish I could remember the songs they sang. I wish I could remember the steps they used. It'd be wonderful to know just how much these traditions were of much older practices. But that was a time, of course, when white people could go to services like this and feel free, because black people could not do the same thing in return, though. But the music was exciting, it was exotic, and it was appealing. All of us wished we could sing that well and dance that well and that freely. That's most important. The next memory, at about the same time, I suppose, is of my mother singing old gospel songs, usually as she went about the house doing her chores, just passing the time, or as often as not, just trying to overcome some feeling of sadness or loneliness living way back there in the country, some grievance that she had against my father. When she sang certain songs, we knew that she had had a spat with him not long before. And one song that she sang, I remember it had this verse: "When the storms of life are raging, stand by me. When the storms of life are raging, stand by me. When I've done the best I can, and my friends misunderstand, thou who rulest wind and water, stand by me." Or more often this one. I want you to participate with me, if you will. The chorus goes something like this. Let me remember the verse here. Let me get into the chorus. Well, when I get there, I'll stop and then coach you in the chorus. If the world from you withhold of its silver and its gold, and you have to get along on meager fare, just remember in his word how he fed the little bird. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. Leave it there, leave it there, that's good. Leave it there, leave it there, leave it there, leave it there. Sing it all parts. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. If you trust and ever doubt, he will surely bring you out. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. Yeah. Yeah, it's really best when you have the repeat harmony and of course, harmony all through. Well, I didn't know until many years later when I started collecting and studying this music that both of those songs were written by an African-American composer named Charles Tenley, one of the fathers of black gospel music. My mother didn't know, and she wouldn't have cared anyway. These songs were aimed at poor people like her, people who needed songs like that, not only to bring them immediate security, but some promise that life would be better on down the road, if not in this world, then beyond it. But Tenley was only one of many black composers, the most famous of which was a former blues pianist and singer named Georgia Tom Dorsey. He got converted sometime in the 30s. He moved into gospel music, moved to Chicago as part of the great black diaspora, and began writing songs like Peace in the Valley and Take My Hand, Precious Lord, one of the best-known songs in the American gospel lexicon. But these writers wrote songs that moved freely, not only among their own people, but into white congregations as well, generally via the old shape note paperback gospel hymnals, and then popularized by quartets, both black and white, that traveled around the country, and popularized by the great revivals at the end of the 19th century. These just reminders of just how widespread and pervasive this gospel tradition was and how colorblind it was. I've heard a lot of people refer to I'll Fly Away, I'm sure what you've all heard, as being a black song, but actually it was written by a white man in Missouri named Albert Bromley, but again, it is moved into the possession of all the American people. How many of you saw the recent documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom? A few. Well, the rest of you need to go see it. One of the best movies of, the last several decades. It's another reminder of just the dramatic impact that Southern-derived music has had upon the world at large. 20 Feet of Stardom is about those black backup singers who backed up the Rolling Stones and Bruce Springsteen, Ray Charles, who else? James Brown, Tina Turner. And I never got any credit for it. Never recognized, usually never named, but without their participation, without their vocal blend, those songs would not have become worldwide hits. Dramatic evidence of the enduring role played by Southern churches, because there's testimony after testimony in the movie from these people that they first learned how to sing, they first learned their style of harmony from fellow church people, particularly from their fathers, who in many cases were preachers. Then the music was taken through the diaspora to the cities of Chicago and Philadelphia and places like that, and finally into the possession of all of us. Well, this, what I've called this synthesis of sound, both black and white, began at the first points of contact between African Americans and Europeans, on the slave ships, in the Caribbean, and from there, much of the synthesis there was taken down to New Orleans and places like that. That's the background for what General Martin called the Spanish tinge, which he thought made New Orleans music so distinctive. Of course, then in the early colonial period, wherever they met, on work projects, in taverns, in brothels, in churches, they learned from each other. African Americans learned the religious lexicon of the Church of England and other churches. They were encouraged to sing, and then in return, they bequeathed their spirit, their particular vocal styles, and other ingredients like that. So we should understand that although blacks and whites generally viewed each other across a seemingly impassable gulf of prejudice, hostility, and violence, they nevertheless created a common folk culture. By that, I mean there was a common body of songs, tunes, performance styles, dances that were known to people of both races. That's not to say that they didn't perform them differently in many cases, but nevertheless, they shared that body of traditions. And they shared a common venue of performance. Dances, community projects, work-related endeavors, of course, church services. In the real world where people lived, you could not separate the spiritual from the secular. But for practical reasons, because it's so much more, it's much easier to explain, I'm going to separate them here today. But just keep in mind that these forces were always interacting with each other and influencing each other. Beginning in the early 1700s, if not before, the slaves were introduced to the tradition of British hymnody and psalmody. As early as 1702, the Church of England, through its Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, began providing songs of varying descriptions to the slaves. That's the reason why some people insisted that the slaves be taught how to read. How are they going to be properly brought into this Christian tradition if they can't read the scriptures and if they can't read the Psalms? So I want to quote to you from a person who was deeply involved in that kind of education. He was the Reverend Samuel Davies. And this is a quote that you often see from 1756 in Hanover, Virginia. Davies was one of the most impassioned exponents of slave literacy, the insistence that they be taught how to read and write. And he continually brought them into his study to teach them. He said, and this is what he said after he began, "For some time after this, the poor slaves, whenever they could get an hour's leisure from their masters, would hurry away to my house and receive the charity with all the genuine indications of passionate gratitude which unpolished nature could give." But he said the books were all very acceptable, but none more so than the book Psalms and Hymns, which enabled them to gratify their peculiar taste for psalmody. And then the quote I like best, he said, "I've often awakened at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning by a torrent of sacred harmony that was pouring into my chamber and carried my mind away to heaven." He's talking about the slaves who were staying up all night to sing these songs. And so the vocal genius of African Americans was noticed very early. And I submit not only was it noticed and commented upon, it was widely imitated. In the early years of the 18th century, in the great camp meetings of that era, held not too far from here at Cane Ridge and other places around the Upper South, slaves participated in great numbers. They weren't integrated, but they were nearby. They were close enough that white people could hear them singing, and white people generally tended to be just overwhelmed by this torrent of sound that they heard. The same had been true earlier in the colonial era. It was very common for slaves and white people to attend the same church services. You might say it's a form of segregation because the white people sat down on the floor in the best seats. The slaves, you know, sat up in the balcony. But again, they could hear each other. I can't prove this. I don't suppose anybody else can, but enough people have commented on it to make me think that it's convincing that changes in the Southern white style of singing was deeply affected by the presence of black people, because black people sang with more freedom, more spontaneity, more emotional timbre. They tended to use their whole bodies instead of just their throats. So to the extent that white people wanted to break away from the conventions of the past and break away from the inhibitions of their own culture, they found models among black singing. The ethnomusicologist, William Talmadge, who taught in New York, and he taught at Berea College for a while, I think, after he retired, he claimed that the chorus itself came from African-American tradition, that until white people heard choruses being used, choruses and refrains, they tended to just sing one verse after another in repetitive fashion. But you have the chorus, and you can sing the verses, and you can come back to the chorus and sing. You know, and after a while, everybody knows at least part of the song. You may not know the verses, but at least you know the chorus. You know, on Jordan's stormy banks I stand and cast a wishful eye. Well, when that song came to America, it came just with a flurry of verses. But somewhere in the United States, somebody added the chorus, I am bound for the promised land. I am bound for the promised land. Oh, come and go with me. I am bound for the promised land. Great for people who often didn't have songbooks, many of whom couldn't read anyway, so you could hear the music being played and some talk to people about the lining the hymn method. You know, you mentioned that that's probably Scottish and learned by the slaves. But some people argue that it were independent traditions, but I think I tend to lean more toward your position. But again, this is an example of how different styles sort of meshed with each other and created what has been dear to all of us. Then at the end of the 19th century, after the emancipation of the slaves, then the free blacks began to be influenced by the great revivals of that period, and none being more important than the great holiness Pentecostal tradition of the 1890s and early years of this century. Black people, again, were very prominent in the early stages of Pentecostalism. Some very prominent preachers like William Seymour, who moved from the South into Texas and then finally to Los Angeles to one of the mother churches of Pentecostalism at the Azusa Street Mission in Los Angeles, where great wondrous sights were seen, you know, speaking in tongue and holy dancing and all sorts of things like that. But again, I think that it was this new infusion of spirit, the idea that you ought to sing the spirit as well as preach it, that opened up singing and made people freer in the style that they used. And I think that, just as an aside, I think that's one reason why you find so many people in American popular music who can point to a Pentecostal background. Elvis Presley and James Brown and B.B. King and Bill Monroe and on and on, white and black. I think it's remarkable how often you'll find some testimony to the strength of Pentecostalism in their past. Because the Pentecostals believed in making a joyful noise to the Lord and using any instrument that was available, from the clapping of the hands, the tambourine, to a five-string banjo, to a full-fledged electronic orchestra. Why should the devil have all the good tunes? Of course, from there, then, as I mentioned briefly earlier, songs began to circulate in paperback hymnals and in the repertoires of quartets, black and white, who began to flourish after the late teens, and particularly with after the coming of radio and recording. Now to backtrack. At the same time, while these events were happening in religious music, black people were also making their mark in instrumental music and in secular music. As is well known, African Americans introduced the banjo to American culture early in the 19th century. But once they introduced it and began popularizing its styles, it was taken over by white people. White manufacturers like S.S. Stewart began reshaping the instrument, putting a back on it in many cases, or changing the strings, changing the covers that the banjos had, making them stronger, more dynamic. And while the banjo was gradually beginning to move into American popular culture in many different guises, African Americans were also were showing a similar fascination with and propensity for the fiddle. That may surprise some of you the most. To ever think of African Americans being associated with what we think of as being a hillbilly instrument, the fiddle. But I've been amazed, no longer amazed, but I was once amazed in doing research at how often in old records, old diaries, plantation manuscripts, runaway slave accounts, newspapers, that not only does a fiddle appear, but it's invariably described as being played by a black person, either a slave or a free person. Slave fiddlers were omnipresent and ubiquitous in the 19th century South. And it seems to me there's no way that that could not have influenced the style and repertoire of white musicians too. Sometime, nobody can say precisely when, but about the first documented example we have of it comes in 1774, when a tutor on a Virginia plantation, a man named Nicholas Criswell, saw and heard a couple of slaves playing a banjo and fiddle together. The historian Reese Isaac later said that this is an important event, but that marks the first hint at cultural fusion in America, when you see a European instrument and an African instrument coming together in the first string band. Then by the late 1830s and 1840s, white men began to appropriate these instruments and create stage performances known as blackface minstrelsy. There's no way that we can overemphasize the influence and the impact of the blackface minstrels. The first person we know of who learned how to play, the first white man who learned how to play the five-string banjo and began giving concerts with it was Joel Walker Sweeney from Appomattox, Virginia. He traveled up and down the seaboard south playing the banjo, putting on shows. He later went to England and Scotland, popularized the style there. Just a few years later, a troop of white men organized the Virginia Minstrels. So again, there's that example of the exotic romantic South, knowing that they knew that people everywhere would be attracted to the music because of the name. But then they purported to be playing music that had been learned directly from black people. These itinerant musicians, you know, argued that they had been south, they'd been on the plantations, they heard the music, they appropriated it, and then went out into the world popularizing it. It's probably true, but how long can you keep a viable form of entertainment going just by playing music that you borrowed from somebody else? Immediately, these talented guys begin making up their own tunes and borrowing them from elsewhere. So that's the reason why we can hear a blackface minstrel song or see a dance that came out of that tradition or hear a style played on the banjo or fiddle, and we cannot say with absolute precision that that came from black sources. Ultimately, they did, but they were reshaped and filtered through the performances of other people. But again, that is that synthesis of style that I've referred to. The black fiddlers of the 19th century had often been given musical instructions by their masters. Some of them were sent off to other places, such as New Orleans, to learn classical style. And then when they returned, they were hired out to plantations to give their performances. So I think these fiddlers were analogous to the musicians that we often describe as songsters. A songster was a person who had different repertoires for different audiences. If he sang for white people, he would give the whites what he thought that they wanted to hear. If he played for black people, he would give them their sound. And those songsters remained important in American popular tradition well up into the 20th century. Southern musical styles than either African-American or European-American, moved into the consciousness of people everywhere through commercial means and popular culture. The blackface minstrels remained popular well into the 20th century. They were followed by other traveling groups like the medicine shows, tent repertoire shows, vaudeville. At the same time, musicians began traveling out of their home areas, all over the South, up into the border regions, taking their music with them. And then the musicians either accompanied or were followed closely by the much larger migration that we call the Great Migration or the Diaspora. Then came the 1920s. When some of the most major innovations of all occurred. 1922, 1923, basically, radio and recording for the first time began utilizing or exploiting the music of grassroots musicians. Before that time, it was almost impossible for string bands or fiddlers or banjo players, gospel singers, anybody else, to dispense their art very far beyond their home regions. You stayed at home and played for fish fries, or you played for house parties. But with the coming of radio, at a time when there was little or no regulation of the sound waves, a person performing on a radio station in Fort Worth or in Atlanta, Georgia, could be heard all over the South and perhaps well up into the Midwest. Phonograph recordings went even further. Jimmy Rogers, the great singing brakeman from Mississippi, had his records disseminated in Africa. They were so popular among some people there that there's a tribe, the Kipsigi tribe in Kenya, I believe it is, who made Jimmy Rogers into a deity. They loved his music so much, they played his records, and they worshipped by what they heard. So the music of the South, in some respects, began to circulate around the world as early as the mid-1920s. Many of our basic musical genres found new life, and in fact, identities, because of radio and recording. Again, it's called the roster of musical genres. Jazz, after about 1917 or so, but particularly after the early 20s. Blues, hillbilly, gospel, Cajun. All were products of this great technological revolution represented by radio and recording. Just to refer to my own specific interest, my own special interest, what we used to call hillbilly music. You can go to the hillbilly records of the 1920s and 30s, and you can find lingering evidence of all these earlier styles that I've referred to. It's possible to do that now because a fellow in England named Tony Russell compiled a book called Country Music Records from 1922 to 1942. This is allegedly a listing of every record made in those decades, along with the name of the people who made the records, the sidemen who were present, the place where the recording was made, and the date. And you go to the listing that he's provided, you're going to find ragtime, jazz, blues, gospel, because the early hillbillies utilized or preserved remnants of everything they'd heard. Of course, music from Tin Pan Alley. I'll end with some references to one of those genres that I described, the blues. I think this brings us probably full circle to the style that's probably had the greatest impact on the music of the world. The blues became part of every style of music that prevailed and endured in this country. But when you look at the history of the blues, you'll find that it's this symbiotic relationship between whites and blacks. The white people who came to the South, particularly from England, well, it didn't matter where you came from, really. Everybody was familiar with the feeling known as the blues. The Elizabethans had used the term blue devils, for example, to describe melancholy or any kind of a feeling of despondency. And at one time or another, the term was used in the late 19th, early 20th century, but the music really didn't begin to take shape until maybe the couple of decades, two or three decades before World War I. The blues was a product of not only of black freedom, but of racial segregation. When black people were forced into their own communities, forced to create their own weapons for survival, their own means of establishing identity. So taking the old work songs, the field hollers, old religious pieces, old spirituals, they began to shape both the style and the feeling of music that we know as the blues. And then they began to popularize this music in traveling shows. Itinerant musicians, of course, played the music down on the street corners. They played at carnivals. They played in honky-tonks. But the music was also disseminated in these medicine shows, tent repertoire shows, in Black Vaudeville. That's the theater owners' booking association where Bessie Smith first built her name. And then finally, in the 20s, the style that had been circulating and gradually taking shape at the grassroots was implanted on phonograph recordings and ultimately popularized around the world. All white people, I think I'm bold enough to say, were familiar with the blues. One could not have escaped hearing the music at one time or another. At the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. It was everywhere. And not only was it heard, but it mirrored the feelings of white people as well as black. Not arguing that white people had as much to be sad about as black people, but nevertheless, they had their grievances too. And the blues helped them to cope with their problems. Again, looking at the old repertoire in hillbilly music, and as I've said, Tony Russell is a good source for this, you're going to find the word blues used over and over and over again in country music from the very beginning of the music's commercial origins in 1922 and 1923. Hillbillies were fascinated by the word. They used it to describe the conventional blues that we think of, but they also used it to describe any kind of feeling. They could describe fiddle tunes that had nothing to do with blues whatsoever, or ragtime pieces. Just again, it's just evidence of just how pervasive the style and the term was. But I'll conclude with this observation. The blues, which was the music of the South, and which became the music of America, its greatest export to the world, was popular because it spoke to everybody, because it mirrored the feelings of us all. So let me end with this. Everybody's had the blues sometime. And everybody knows the tune. And everybody knows the way I'm feeling. 'Cause everybody's had the blues. A lonely song, someone is gone. A story old as time. Love, hate, want, and wait till misery rules your mind. Yes, everybody knows the way I'm feeling. 'Cause everybody had the blues. Yes, everybody's had the blues. Thank you. It's a facet of the larger picture, a revival of styles that were popular, say, before the late 1930s, mm-hmm. mostly string band music, although there are a lot of old songs involved in it, too. And I should say, if I'd taken this whole thing forward, you know, I would have stressed the so-called folk music revival of the 1950s and early 60s, because that's when people throughout America began rediscovering these old forms of music, everything from country to blues. And so there was a real revival of all of these styles. I think you probably couldn't have jazz without the infusion of the blues. But you can have the blues without having that full paraphernalia of jazz instruments, that sort of thing. I'm not an expert on either one of those styles, but I've heard it argued convincingly that the blues is a central ingredient, the river that jazz flowed out of. To the panel of experts over here to my left, thank you.